Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. President Obama has said that over the next 3 years, he wants to double the amount of energy that comes from renewable sources. In his first address to the Congress, the president said energy is critical to America's future. He said the country that harnesses the power of clean, renewable energy will lead the 21st century. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll try to spend some time talking about the future of renewables, those that have the greatest potential, some of the challenges involved in developing them and bringing them online. And we have as our guest Dr. Dan Arvizu. He is the director of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and that's located in Golden, Colorado. He's had that job since the beginning of 2005. The lab began operations in 1977. It is the Department of Energy's main lab for energy efficiency and renewable energy research and development. He's also worked at the Sandia National Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and started his career and spent 4 years at the AT&T Bell Telephone Laboratories. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that just that people try to keep their questions brief and comments brief so we can accommodate as many callers as possible and try to keep our program moving along. But certainly, questions are welcome from callers. And if you want to join the conversation, it's very easy. If you are in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to join in, you can give us a call. Dr. Arvizu, hello.
Good morning, David. It's great to be with you.
Well, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time. This is obviously a very big area. So as a way of trying to break it down at least a little bit to start, let's set aside for the moment at least liquid transportation fuels and try to concentrate a little bit on electricity generation. And so let me ask you this question then. If you look at the various methods that we use now in the United States to produce electricity, can you just run down the list and then talk about how much, you know, what of our demand is satisfied by that particular generation method?
Okay, so our electric generation capacity in the country is mostly dominated by fossil fuels, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. Primarily, it's coal and natural gas. I don't know the precise numbers nationally. I know here in Colorado, over 60% of our electricity comes from coal. I think it's a little bit less than that nationally. And then a large fraction is natural gas. We've put a lot of new peaking generation in over the last 10 to 15 years, and that's been primarily natural gas. And then there is about 6% that's hydro power, and something equivalent to that I think is nuclear. In fact, I think it's a little bit more than that. Almost 20% is nuclear, and then we have a very, very small percent, approaching 1%, that is what we call kind of the new renewable energy, such as wind and solar, biomass, and geothermal.
Okay. So that definitely, that's the point that I'm getting at, is that, and this is probably not going to be a surprise to people, but in fact, that fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, are the biggest generator of electricity, and nuclear power generation is also very significant. But
right.
The kinds of things that here we're talking about, things like solar power, wind energy, geothermal,
right,
is still the contribution there to our demand for electricity now is really quite small.
That's correct.
All right. Now, the just talking about what the president has said, apparently now the White House is saying their goal would be to see 10% of our electricity need met by renewables by the year 2012 and 25% by 2025. Now, that just meeting that goal, you know, when you see now that maybe it's only 1%, and what we're talking about, what the president is talking about, is to increase that by up to 10%,
mm-hmm.
And he's talking about 3 years, that is extraordinarily maybe optimistic and ambitious. Now, I'll ask this question. Do you think that that's a goal that we can meet?
Well, it's a perennial problem. The question that gets asked frequently is, you know, what can we achieve and by what time frame? It clearly is a very ambitious goal. I think the latest things that we've heard is, you know, doubling the renewable energy generation capacity of electricity over the next 3 years. I think that's certainly very doable. Getting to 10% is much more difficult. I'm not sure we can get to 10% in the next 3 years. But I think I'm optimistic that if we decide that we want to achieve some significant fraction, and I've testified in front of Congress a number of times, and always given kind of the same response when they ask me what can we actually achieve and by when, my response to that is we can achieve whatever we put our mind to. It's not a matter of technical potential. It is a matter of will. It's a matter of priorities. It's a matter of investment. Now, ramping up more quickly than what would be more what I would call methodical and thoughtful approaches will cost more. But we need to invent the future that we want. It's not a matter of can we get there. It is a matter of do we want to get there, and by when, and how much do we want to invest. So to move as quickly as 10% in 3 years, I think, is probably overly ambitious. To double in 3 years, certainly very doable. To get to 25% by 25, again, ambitious but doable. So we've done several studies for the U.S. Department of Energy, and we've talked about a 20% of our electricity capacity from wind alone by the year 2030. It's something that T. Boone Pickens and the President and others have talked about relative to what wind can provide. We think solar can provide another 10% by the same kind of time frame, 2025, 2030. But unless we start now, we won't achieve either of those goals.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that the administration would say something like, there's nothing to be gained by setting the bar low.
Right.
So you want to set an ambitious goal. But again, it sounds like you're saying that a more conservative estimate over the next 3 years would be a doubling, which would still, that would only bring us to 2%.
Right? And that's correct. That's correct. But it would put us on a trajectory to get much more quickly. You know, we've learned some lessons by having the states each take their own approaches. You know, I live in a state, Colorado, where the voters back several years ago voted in what they call a renewable portfolio standard, a renewable electricity standard. It said, you know, we wanted to see, I think we originally started at 10% by the year 2015 or something like that. We quickly passed that, went right into let's go to 20% by the year 2020, and we'll actually exceed that as well. You know, one could argue we're in a state that's blessed with a lot of renewable resources. At the same time, it was because the voters decided they wanted to move in that direction that we marshaled all of the technical know-how, the manufacturing know-how, and the political will to all make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said just a moment ago that as far as developing these sources of energies, it's not a matter of technical potential. It's a matter of will and investment. And so it comes down to how much money are you willing to put into the effort? If we ask this question, well, at this point, mm-hmm. how much money is the federal government investing in R&D in renewables? What's that number?
Well, it's a very small number. You know, if you don't count kind of the legislation that's happened as a result of stimulus and or the omnibus that's about, about to pop here in the near term, the amount of federal resources with the Department of Energy that's focused and directed on renewable energy specifically is a pretty small number. It's you know, $1.2 billion has been the budget for the energy efficiency and renewable energy part division of the Department of Energy. A lot of that is not R&D. A lot of that is weatherization programs, deployment type programs. So the actual R&D piece is actually much smaller than even that. So it has been a fairly modest amount over the course of the last. 20 years. There was a time early in the Carter years where the budgets went up really, really fast, and then they came down really, really fast. But for the last 10 or 15, it's been pretty flat, and a very modest amount of relative to the nature of the problem, relative to the amount of energy sales and consumption we have in this country.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about there will be some money going into this area from the recent economic stimulus plan that the Congress passed, but I gather that at this point you really don't know. Is it that you don't know how much money it is, or that you're not exactly sure how it's going to be divvied up?
It's the latter. It certainly is a lot of money. The amount of money that this organization within the Department of Energy will steward is literally increased by a factor of 10. So, where it was previously, I think the FY08 budget was $1.7 million for that particular department. They have close to $18 billion dollars to spend as part of both stimulus and omnibus. Now, how that will be divided and to what it will be allocated is still not clear, and that's kind of being worked out by officials at the Department of Energy.
All right. Our guest, let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Dan Arvizu. He's the director of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. That's located in Golden, Colorado. That's the DOE's main lab for energy efficiency and renewable energy research and development. And that is really what we're talking about here this morning, trying to talk a little bit about the potential for renewables here in the United States and what we might expect over the next couple of decades we could be doing in terms of using renewables, things like solar power, wind energy, geothermal, to generate electricity. Questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have somebody on our toll-free line calling from Wheeling up in the northern part of the state. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just last week I picked up a book by Augusta Golden on geothermal energy, a hot prospect. It was published in 1981. And I just turned on this program, and I want to ask you about the possibilities. Is this feasible? I haven't even read it. I'm not real knowledgeable, but here's a question.
Okay. Well, that's and I think maybe it's one that is one form that is geothermal that we don't maybe hear quite as much about. The fastest growing area is wind. People, I guess they understand, what a solar panel is, kind of. But geothermal, I think, is one that maybe people are much less familiar with. What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, I don't know. I honestly haven't read the book.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm not asking. I'm not asking the call. I'm
would
asking
like
the,
to know if it's feasible and if people are looking into this.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, let me say a word about geothermal. I started in the renewable energy business in the mid-1970s, so I've been around the programs, both of the Department of Energy and a number of projects that have gone on around the country for the better part of 3 decades now. Geothermal is a mature technology. It obviously is an electric generation resource that uses the heat that's stored in the earth. That typically they call it geo because it's a geoscience resource. But essentially, it's the heat coming from the core of the earth that finds its way through fractures in the earth's crust, and it kind of finds its way to the surface. The geysers in Yellowstone National Park, for instance, and those things that we hear about in our parks and areas like that. Have access to this heat energy close to the surface, and sometimes it's connected to water. So we've been tapping that for some time. There's a number of projects around the country. There's actually something like 2,000 megawatts, maybe even more than that, 2,000 to 3,000 megawatts of geothermal energy that's in service and production today. Now, sounds like a lot. It is a lot relative to everything else. It's a very small fraction. And these projects have been very mature. So where you've got that resource, where you've got hot springs, where you've got areas where the resource is close to the surface and easy to get at, very, very conventional technology that the oil and gas industry knows about, they can drill down and tap into that heat. And then you use that heat in a process that allows you to, through a turbine, convert that from heat to electricity. So it's a very, very conventional thermal cycle that you'd use. So the technology works. It works very, very well. There are some countries like Iceland who have really exploited it because, you know, Iceland kind of sits on a volcano in the ocean. So they end up tapping it, and they get something like 40% of their energy from geothermal. Very established, very well respected. I've seen, you know, some very state-of-the-art facilities that they've had. We haven't pursued this technology nearly as aggressively as we could have. Part of it is we've looked at all the easy to get resources that are near load centers, so you don't have to build transmission wires and those kinds of things. And so we've kind of tapped the ones that are easy. But there's a huge resource that we really haven't tapped. And there's a new generation of that technology called enhanced geothermal energy. So this new enhanced geothermal really has to do with drilling very, very deep into the Earth's core and tapping some of that energy. People would argue that it's infinite, limitless. On the scale that we speak about, it really is a huge reservoir of energy. The technology is not quite there to allow us to tap into that as cost effectively as we need to in order to be competitive in the marketplace, but certainly an area where there is great interest. Because, as I mentioned earlier, our R&D budgets have been so modest over the course of the past 30 years, we really haven't had the opportunity to explore some of these potential resources and develop them. And so we, you know, because you have limited amount of money, you say, okay, what are the one or two things I can do? And so very, very good options essentially get put on the shelf. Just as recently as 2-3 years ago, we were talking about completely shutting down the R&D efforts in geothermal. Not because there wasn't great potential, but simply because there just wasn't enough of a priority at the national scale to go and develop those resources. I think what we're seeing, certainly with this new administration, is a reinvigoration of that interest in let's explore these options that heretofore have not yet been explored. And there was a big MIT study on geothermal not too long ago that talked about the great potential. Again, it's been around since the late 70s, early 80s, kind of first generation. Next generation, I think, really has great potential. There's literally $400 million in the new stimulus package to look at geothermal very seriously. So the question from the caller was on target with, yes, there are some opportunities that we simply have not yet explored. It will take some time to develop that. I mean, it's not going to be like next year we're going to see geothermal plants popping up all over the place. But in short order, I believe there will be a new resource that we can point to that will be significant in terms of the energy mix of the country.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is it the case that that geothermal might be something like a hydro in the sense that it's dependent on it's location specific, and it's something that you can't just put one anywhere?
That's correct.
That sort of leads me to thinking about whether in future, if we're talking about green energy or renewable energy, that maybe different parts of the country, depending on what sort of resources they have and what sort of issues they have, maybe different forms are better suited to one place or another.
That's a great question and a great lead-in for one of the key points I like to make about renewables, is that we used to think about the distributed nature of renewables as being a liability, as being one of the characteristics that were challenges. In fact, it is because the resource is both distributed and diverse that I think it can become a very significant asset and characteristic of that resource. As you suggest, every part of the country isn't blessed with either wind or sunshine or biomass, biofuels or geothermal. But most every part of the country has something, and everybody has the opportunity to improve on efficiency. So there is, very nice characteristic that suggests that the entire country can participate. I think the U.S. is blessed with great renewable resources relative to the rest of the world. And even within our country, even in the Southwest, Southeast, which you don't normally think of in terms of resources, there are resources that can be tapped. And, I think biofuels, I think efficiency and those kinds of things that are part of the mix. And so everyone has an opportunity to participate, not perhaps at the same degree or same level, but there is, in fact, something that is in this for all regions of the country. I think that's a real asset today in today's environment, where we're now beginning to really appreciate the value that a distributed renewable resource actually does provide.
All right, let's talk with somebody here, someone calling on a cell phone. They're on the road somewhere on I-74, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As a person who's also interested in the environment, I'm often torn between questions about renewable energy and the environmental impact. And in central Illinois, it looks like wind energy is the direction we're moving. Would you please speak to the what's known about the environmental impact of wind-generated electricity? And I'll hang up and listen off air. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you for your question. Certainly, one of the things that we've been very attentive to as we've thought through what should be the strategy for employing large amounts of renewable energy, whether it be wind, solar, geothermal, or biofuels. And that question comes up. If we're touting these resources as having, a great deal of environmental friendliness to them, then we really have to think through life cycle analysis of what are the impacts. So everything. We try to look at this at the national level. We try to look at what are the implications of widespread use of these technologies when it comes to how do they affect water use, land use, how do they affect the value chain of the various competing technologies, and how do they change both the economic landscape as well as the environmental landscape. So, if we're thoughtful and prudent and don't kind of shoot from the hip and do it in a much more methodical way, I think we can accommodate all of those concerns that say what are the long-term impacts if you do that. Now, specific to wind, we've been researching wind now literally 30 years plus, and obviously there have been windmills for, probably thousands of years. And one of the things I think in today's environment where these wind turbines are becoming much more sophisticated items that are first of all huge and large in many respects intrusive to the environment, we have thought through what does that mean in terms of both are there issues with wildlife like avian issues and birds and bats and the things that you keep hearing about? Are there impacts on, for instance, flight patterns when airplanes and around airports and those kinds of things? So we've thought through all of those, and I think and clearly there's a matter of judgment when it comes to viewshed. Putting wind turbines next to your ski resort area, is that something that people are going to appreciate and applaud, or are they going to be concerned about how it might otherwise affect their attributes of the environment that they're wanting to enjoy? And all of those things are part of the mix. And when we get right down to it, I think these are judgment calls as to how do you trade off some of these risks and some of these impacts relative to what you're trying to accomplish. Because if you're honest about things, what you really ought to be doing is looking at all of your energy sources and saying what are the relative improvements, both in environmental impact as well as quality of life, and those are the kind of judgments and trade-offs that I think should inform our national energy policy. So there certainly are impacts with relates to wind. Most of those we have judged in terms of national reports, National Academy reviews. To suggest that they are relatively benign, that they are minimal in relation to the kind of objectives and the benefits that they also provide. So there's a lot of things to be discussed about that, including how do they connect to the grid and what are the influences on reliability and what are the costs. It's complicated. It's not a simple, oh yeah, this is good, this is bad. It is a matter of a set of criteria that you then judge against. And then you make an informed decision that this is a better alternative than some other alternative.
And just it seems that from what I read and from what you've said of the various kinds of renewables that we could talk about, that wind seems to be the thing, or maybe I should ask in the form of a question: is this the one that seems to have the greatest potential?
Well, potential is really a relative term based on time scale. So in the short term, certainly wind is the most cost-effective. It is going to provide you, have the greatest impact in the shortest term, which is why we always a little bit concerned about when we talk about renewable electricity standards and say we want a certain percent of our energy from renewables. If you don't put some additional conditions on that requirement, you're going to get all wind because essentially wind is the lowest cost, the most mature of the various technologies. Now you asked the question about potential, and I have my own personal biases, but I will offer that long term, you know, maybe mid-century, you know, maybe beyond, that the resource that will have the greatest potential is solar. There's more. You know, I mean, you hear all the numbers, and they're kind of eye-popping to some degree. I think they make a point. They're really not all that relevant. But there's more energy hitting the Earth, you know, on an hourly basis than the entire planet uses in a year. Well, that's an interesting statistic, but it speaks to the enormity of the resource. In terms of technical potential, in terms of the ability to capture it, convert it to useful work, useful services, on the scale that mankind needs, I think long-term solar will be your greatest natural resource that will, you know, I think in many respects probably dwarf all the others combined.
Well, real quick, and I have some other callers. I want to make sure I don't make these people wait. We have sort of different scales that we can think about here. An individual could have, you know, considering that the site limitations and all, an individual could have a wind turbine for their home. They could put solar panels on their home. Or on the other end, we could think about a wind farm where we've got many wind turbines, and I guess we could also think about a sun farm, I suppose, putting out, you know, going out in the desert someplace where the sun shines all the time, and we got all this empty space, and we could put as many solar panels as we could get. Mm-hmm. Now, again, given that we're talking about a sort of a different model. The older model is build the biggest plant you possibly can and have fewer plants and serve as many people as you can. So we're moving sort of toward this model that says, no, maybe that doesn't make any sense. Maybe it makes more sense to generate the power closer to the place where you use it and you have many. So that's what we're talking about, distributed.
Right.
So, you know, having said all that, is the idea of having gigantic wind farms, you know, wind farms that could generate as much power as your average nuclear power plant, for example, or giant sun farms. I mean, is that really what we're the kind of idea that we're thinking about or moving toward?
I think the question is certainly well posed, and it is precisely the kinds of things that we're talking about in terms of a national strategy. I think you need both. It's clearly that the present electric grid system was built on the concept of big power plants, big wires, and you connect these, and everybody kind of taps from where they need. We need to rethink that entire architecture, that entire structure. Clearly, transmission and distribution is becoming more and more problematic as you go through load centers because, quite frankly, people don't like to see big power lines coming through the middle of their neighborhood. So there's a value to collecting near where you're going to use the resource. So that distributed nature actually is a very compelling and very interesting part of a new strategy. What it needs is what we keep calling the smart grid, because the grid that we have today wasn't designed for that, and it doesn't really easily accommodate, either a variable load or for that matter, a variable supply. And you need both. You need to be able to accommodate people, making demands on the electric system at different times of day, at different levels, and then you need to be able to also accommodate the fact that the sun doesn't shine at night and the wind doesn't always blow. Those are obviously variable resources that we can plan into a system that's supplemented by other base loads, whether that be natural gas or, you know, some carbon-free fossil fuel, maybe nuclear, maybe base load geothermal. All of those need to be part of the mix, but the system needs to be smart enough to accommodate all that. And I think that's the change that needs to occur. If we don't actively make that change happen, it won't happen in any time that's relevant to the kind of challenges that we have in front of us.
Dr. Dan Arvizu is our guest. He is the director of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. It's in Golden, Colorado. It's the DOE's main lab for energy efficiency and renewable energy research and development. And we're talking about the potential for renewables. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's go to a caller here on line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Question about limitations in two of the technologies you've talked about. First, with geothermal, as I understand it, with the geothermal electric generation, what they're doing is drilling for pockets of steam and water, that's the only, you know, practical way to generate the energy. And so they could drill to the magma, but I don't know what the problem is there. Actually, it seems like you would melt anything that you tried to stuck in the magma. And so I was going to ask if you could talk about specific research that's being done to overcome that problem, if I've got it right. And the other thing is something I've always wondered about and never heard anything about. I'm in favor of the wind turbines. It seems like it's necessary. But I always wonder what would happen to them in a tornado. Do they have any kind of, like, safety feature? And that's it.
Yeah. Okay, let me see if I can address those directly and briefly. On geothermal, the technology of drilling for steam that's already, you know, resident in the Earth's crust is first-generation technology, kind of the hydrothermal process. It's been around for a long time, and we're kind of tapping that, although it's what you find that the balancing those reservoirs is really difficult sometimes, and you get water depletion and a variety of things to go with that. The next generation will be drilling down into the crust till you get to a certain temperature regime, so you wouldn't go down so far that you start melting things, but you go down far enough that you get a significant temperature differential, and then you inject water from the surface, and you then use the water as the heat transfer media to get you to the top. And there's certain reservoir engineering kinds of things that you would do. You rubblize the pockets or whatever to get better heat transfer uniformity. There's a number of geosciences research efforts that need to take place before we can really optimize that type of technology. So that's the second generation geothermal, and it is, in fact, the subject of, I think, the new programs that we're going to see getting started as part of the new stimulus package and national research effort. Let's see. The second question was
about
relative to wind turbines.
Turbines in a tornado. Yeah,
we're turbines and tornadoes. Well, we're doing a bunch of research, and we've done a lot of research for a long time. Here in Colorado, you know, at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, we have a National Wind Technology Center, and it really is not on our main campus. It's around the back of the mountains, right at the foothills, and there's this kind of natural Venturi formation that we sit at the mouth of. And so we get winds of like 140 miles an hour. So it's actually a great place to do destructive testing on these massive machines. We're currently putting up a 1.5 megawatt turbine, which is a very, very tall turbine. And shortly later this summer, we'll put up a 2.3 megawatt turbine. These are huge. 107 meter diameter of the rotor on these machines. You know, 400 feet tall, etc. And what they do have is they do have stow mechanisms that allow them to ride through these very, very high wind conditions. So at least up to 140 miles an hour, they're certainly designed to withstand those kind of harsh conditions. And we'll look at kind of what are the effects of that. They don't operate at those wind speeds, but what we find is that they're pretty rugged machines and designed to take some pretty high wind loads, as you would expect. Whether or not they can take 200 miles an hour, you know, Category 5 kind of thing, hurricane or whatever, I'm not sure that's possible. But certainly we'll look at what those limits are and we'll make them as resilient as possible.
All right. Next caller is Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a comment and a question. So the comment is, one of the differences you remarked where you were talking about giant installations versus residential sort of installations. And one of the things about the giant installations is that they compete at the wholesale price instead of the retail price. So that puts them at a disadvantage, as I understand it. And then the question that I had is, what is the effect of some of the recent breakthroughs in solar cells reducing the manufacturing price?
Okay, so let me just make a quick remark to the comment. On the comment, certainly the big renewable farms, whether they be wind turbines or you know, either concentrating solar power or even photovoltaics, There is an economy of scale that goes along with those big giant fields, and it's a little bit different marketplace than the residential, as the caller accurately points out. You do compete on the wholesale market, and I think over time those costs will come down. I mean, what's going on right now is this notion that we're actually demanding that we're going to get a certain fraction of our generation from those types of technologies. What that's doing is it's generating the private sector investment. It's generating the opportunity for the technology to evolve in the normal learning curve sort of mode, and great progress is being made there. So I think ultimately we will get to points where it is competitive with conventional technology, and it'll be what my good friend Vinod Khosla, who's a big venture capitalist, did very well in the IT business, is now making a lot of investments in the renewable energy area. He suggests that we need to get down to what he calls the Chindia price, the price that's competitive in China and India. I think that's absolutely essential that we do that. We need to be able to compete in a way that doesn't require government subsidies. The technology can do that. It will take time. And so getting the government in engagement at the beginning of this thing is an important piece of that, moving that down that technology curve. Now, the effects on solar cells, there's what I'm most excited by is, I was in the laboratory literally 30 years ago when we were making the first solar cells that now are today's commercial product. And I just put a 7-kilowatt array on my roof in my home here in Denver. And the technology that I put on my roof is a technology that we had at the laboratory scale literally 30 years ago, developed in the research labs around the country and the universities, just wonderful stuff. I fast forward and I say, okay, 30 years later, we now have that as commercial product. In the laboratory today, and I have the privilege of leading this national laboratory that's kind of the centroid of most important pioneering efforts on solar energy right now. And we've got some things going on in the laboratory that are absolutely phenomenal, absolutely just, knock your socks off kind of breakthroughs that are occurring at the laboratory level, not yet commercial, but at the laboratory level on nanostructures and organic thin films and a variety of things that we're at the same level, that we were 30 years ago. And when I get a chance to talk to the administration, I talked to President Bush when he came out and visited us. I've talked to the present administration. I tell them all the same thing. It is our job to make sure it doesn't take 30 years to get these technologies into the marketplace. So the fact that these technologies are moving down a cost curve that at one time, we projected that, we were going to do that many, many years ago, and it just took us forever to get there. I think now with a renewed emphasis on the research and development and more importantly, the commercialization and deployment of these technologies, I think it won't be, 3 decades before we see the breakthroughs of today finding their ways into the marketplace. So the implications are huge. But as I said at the beginning of the program, it is really about a matter of will and continued investment, because the innovation engine is really what's going to get us to where we need to be. And what we're doing now in terms of deployment is harvesting the investments over that 30-year period to now. What we need to do is not lose sight of the fact that we need to continue to make investments in the R&D, because that's what's going to take us. That's the pipeline that's going to be deployed into the future.
I guess my question was more specific that, for example, the first solar announcements of under a range of $1 a watt production cost could potentially give us grid parity now, even in the Midwest.
Yeah, I would stop short of making that leap, although I'm very, very comfortable and very much of an advocate of the First Solar team, because they have just done a phenomenal job. We like to take a lot of credit for the fact that technology was, in many respects, pioneered here at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and their success is really our success, because it is a demonstration that, boy, you can move thin film second-generation technology, because they work on a cadmium telluride base, is ready for prime time. There are a lot of issues still related to how do you include these technologies into the existing grid mix. As you can fully appreciate, I mean, the fact is that electricity is valuable when there is a high demand. So in other words, if you are able to serve a load that's at peak, then the value of that electricity is very much greater than the value of electricity when nobody wants it. And And that time of day use and pricing is not something that our grid exactly passes to consumers. I mean, the utilities deal with that on their basis, on their side of the meter, but on the consumer side of the meter, we pay a flat price independent of whatever the cost is. So that technology can, in fact, in certain regions of the country, be at grid parity today. Now, it can't compete with, coal at night because, obviously, you don't generate at night. But we don't have that pricing signal in the marketplace yet developed to the point where we can take full advantage of the fact that that technology, in fact, is being able to provide energy at the time when it is most valuable.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers here. Our guest, again, is Dr. Dan Arvizu. He's the director of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. It's located in Golden, Colorado. We're talking about the potential for renewables in the energy mix here in this country. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, over to the community of Belgium, not that far away, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, all. As Mr. Inge knows, I am highly interested in hydrogen. Now, I understand there are many problems with infrastructure and stuff like that, but remember, John Kennedy took us from staring at the moon to being on the moon in 10 years. Right. There's no reason why we couldn't do this job, too, in the same general time frames. But what I would want to comment on more than anything else is a statement you made earlier about the solar impact on the face of the Earth, and so much of it really goes to waste. Well, it really doesn't, because plants turn it from photons into sugars, then starches, and then cellulose, and they do it in a very, very efficient way. Well, I guess not that efficient. They use about 10-15% efficiency, but there's so much of it, it works pretty good. Oh, we never use that paradigm to try to generate electricity by cutting it and just turning it into hydrogen and then producing it. And then to generate hydrogen on site, because most of our trips are very short, so we could generate our own hydrogen on our roofs and put it into our basements and use it through a fuel cell to not only generate electricity for our houses, but for our car also. We would have to monitor how much we use for driving and how much we use for house use, but it's okay. And a final point, in Europe, Philips Corporation is generating working on houses that work strictly on 12 volts so that you don't have to go through a power grid. I was wondering if you could comment on any or all those.
Okay, we'll do. In fact, I love the elegance of a hydrogen economy, the idea that hydrogen is such a wonderful energy carrier. As we all know, it doesn't occur naturally. We have to generate it from something. But it's a wonderful carrier because the byproducts are, water and heat, the things that you actually care about. And so it's a wonderful and elegant technology. It was interesting to me that Henry Ford, when he was actually developing the platform for the automobile, actually considered, all different kinds of fuels, and hydrogen was one of them. And it's too bad he picked gasoline, because that's kind of what we've got today, although we understand why. So all that said, we actually do have some wonderful research programs. I've got a whole research team here working on the direct conversion of solar to hydrogen, doing the artificial photosynthesis process that you spoke about. In fact, we learn a lot from nature. We have these what we call biomimetic sorts of processes in engineering that are all part of a whole body of study that I think eventually we will get some keys to how to do things much, much better in the future. So all of that is really, really important. And I think the distributed nature of renewable energy allows you to think about generating, some carriers, whether they be, biofuels or bioelectricity or whatever, in a way that gets you to a different way in which we both generate and consume energy. And the hydrogen discussion brings into question, what are we trying to accomplish? I mean, it's not just about energy. It's about the service that energy provides. And so we need to rethink our transportation sector. We need to think our electricity sector. We need to think how we use energy. We've grown accustomed to wasting a lot of energy because it's been relatively easy to get and fairly cheap. And now we're recognizing, well, it's not so easy to get, and really it's got other impacts that we didn't fully appreciate when we designed the system in the first place. So that architecture and that change of a paradigm that says we, you know, and I like to say we need to invent the future that we want, because if we just continue on the path that we've been, we got here, you know, with a different set of assumptions, and now we recognize the challenges and all those kinds of things. So all of that relates to infrastructure, transportation, end use, and I think looking at things in a systemic kind of overall life cycle analysis sort of way that gives you a sustainable energy paradigm that really does all the things we want it to do, cheap and affordable, and at the same time allows there to be economic growth and movement in that direction.
I want to get one more caller here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm calling about I have a question about wind turbines. I was wondering, do those have to be turned into the wind, or that's my first question.
Well, short answer is that's what you typically have, and we have designs that, you know, there's been vertical axis wind turbines, the so-called Darius wind turbines. There are turbines that will orient themselves directly into the wind, or, you know, downstream of the wind. So it's an upstream or downstream sort of a design concept. Most of what you see is that, yes, they do orient themselves automatically into the wind, and that way you get your maximum power. But they can be designed in a number of different ways.
My second question is, if you used an anemometer with a generator, anemometers, those are those wind speed measures for weather and stuff, and you put a generator up in it, could that generate electricity, you know? And if it did, why couldn't you line them up on the interstate or something and just, you know, use the wind from the cars going by to charge up the power?
Well, you know, I appreciate the question, because I think it certainly demonstrates the creativity that people have regarding what can we really do that really begins to take the ubiquitous resource that we have and convert it into something useful. Certainly, an anemometer can generate energy. It typically is a small amount of energy. I mean, that's why we design these systems the way they're designed, is because it optimizes the way in which they convert the wind resource into electricity, and it turns out that, you know, the bigger you go, essentially the more efficient you get. But that's not to say that in certain locations, small wind turbines — we haven't spent a lot of time working on small wind turbines. I had a call from a senator the other day. He says, you know, I've been looking at a small wind turbine for my house, and the numbers don't pencil out. And, you know, my encouragement to him was, we haven't put the kind of time and energy on smaller wind turbines that we have on bigger wind turbines. But certainly for consumers and residential, that might actually be a very promising area for some additional research. We haven't done that. But there are some opportunities out there that we simply haven't tapped. In fact, I'd say there's lots of opportunities we haven't tapped. But we haven't been thinking about distributed resources as aggressively as we could and should. And again, I think that is all part of hopefully the changing landscape.
Yeah, I could just visualize, you know, everybody driving electric cars, you know, and everything, you know, not your hot water and your furnace and everything, but instead of running off gas and everything, can run off electricity, you know?
Yeah, absolutely true. And in fact, I travel around the world and recognize that, you know, most parts of several nations are way ahead of us here in the U.S. People think about these things in Europe and in Asia in ways that we have only begun to think about. And, you know, that's another one of my hot buttons is I keep telling our elected officials, this is an area that the U.S. ought to lead. We've got more innovation and ingenuity in this country than anywhere in the world, and we can tap this and not only benefit ourselves, but make it a competitive advantage for technology worldwide. And the rest of the world is looking for U.S. leadership here. I mean, this is time for us to do this, and I think, you know, all of these ideas that people have are very, very valuable and can be used as part of the new energy economy.
We just have about a minute, unfortunately, and I think we certainly appreciate you giving us the overview. I think now what we have to do, perhaps in the month ahead, we'll do some other shows, and we should concentrate on just one form. We could do a whole hour just talking about solar, and an hour about talking about wind, and an hour on geothermal, and we'll see about that. Just one quick question. You know, your comment was one of the problems with some of these forms is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And maybe if we had the right kind of grid, that wouldn't matter as much. But is anybody realistically thinking about some way to store energy generated by these forms so that then when it was needed, it could be used?
Well, certainly an area that, you know, I have frequently called the Achilles heel of renewable energy is that we don't really have what I would call yet the right or a great storage technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the new stimulus package calls for a major initiative around batteries. I think batteries are a subset of a larger storage requirement. And whether or not you're talking about, you know, stored hydro where you can pump water from one location to another and use that as a storage media, or whether you're talking about underground compressed gas or compressed air, there are a number of things that have been contemplated. As of yet, we don't have that magic, you know, storage technology. For vehicles, battery seems to be the right one, but battery technology is just slow to develop. We just need to have a bigger effort on that. So to answer your question, absolutely need a huge storage initiative, and that will really release the opportunity for renewable energy as much as you know, a smart grid will.
All right. Well, there we have to leave it with the promise that we will come back to these issues on future programs. But for the moment, we need to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Dan Arvizu. He is the director of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. Dr. Arvizu, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to address your listeners.